We've got a whole range of questions here, Venerable.
Okay, let's go.
So there's a couple, one from Marius and one from Gail Bell that kind of go together. So Marius mentioned that how COVID reveals our partiality, and actually, you know, we don't really worry about the world or the rest of the people until COVID could, you know, impact us. But we, you know, we're not moved by millions killed in recent wars or anything. And Gail Bell from Stratty asked, did you mention that we can use our illness to benefit others, or our, you know, our fear of COVID to benefit others, the others that are actually, you know, experiencing the result? What can we do if we're not experiencing the result?
Okay. So this is where, you know, we've got the two wings of the bird. Wisdom wing and compassion wing. And so Maris's point is, first of all, the really good point. It's we all can see that. You know, if you've got, you're living in a nice suburb and you've got lovely things and everything's nice and the wife is there every day, the husband's there, the kids are there, you go to school, come home, everything's consistent, no dramas happen. And then suddenly your child gets murdered. So everything changes and suddenly you become concerned, you're full of compassion, you're full of outrage, you start a foundation just to prevent people from murdering children, but it's always been happening. Next door could have been having worse suffering, but we never even pay attention to other people's suffering because until it happens to us. And all this proves is just, I mean, this is where we have to really look into the depths of attachment and aversion, the delusions. When we look into the high school level of practice, when we become our own therapists, when we realize the depth of attachment and the depths of, and this is way more subtle than we could really ever imagine, Marius. It's really quite profound. You see, this is why even we analyze attachment and aversion and link this to karma and why good things happen and why bad things happen. And it really starts to show us all the assumptions we have deep in our bones. So for example, attachment's job is this junkie in us, this frantic emotional hunger. Every second it is there. There's levels of subtlety that we can't even imagine yet. It's assumption, basically, it's an assumption. And basically its assumption is that only the good things should happen. So now due to our incredible past virtue, due to our lots of non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, to our generosity, to our virtue from past lives, we at the moment have a relatively good life, living in Brisbane, living in somewhere where things are lovely. So what do? We don't think of it. Every second, we never think of it. Oh my God, I'm so fortunate. I can't believe, you know, in other words, you look out in your veggie garden, you've got 5 acres or a hectare of vegetables, delicious, beautiful vegetables, because you imagine this, you've never heard of botany, you have no idea why those vegetables are there, you don't know why, so you totally take it for granted, and because you've got attachment, you then have this hubris of thinking, oh, aren't I lucky, you wake up every morning, I'm so fortunate having these vegetables, oh, the universe is kind to me, or you blame somebody else for it, but you never question why. It's the fruit of your unbelievable years and years of hard gardening, but you don't remember. So we take it for granted. We take the good for granted. Why? Because attachment, this junkie, is getting what it wants every second. So this is hubris of attachment that anyway, I deserve all these good vegetables. I don't know where they come from. I don't know. I don't care. Just give me more, please. This is the hubris of attachment, and we live in it. And it looks like we're just being a nice person, but it's so arrogant. And then what happens? Suddenly, your daughter gets murdered, you lose your job, you get COVID-19. So what happens then? Your attachment suddenly didn't get what it wanted. So now you have this panic attack of outrage and anger and fear and drama. How dare this happen to me? So what attachment is saying, I deserve the good things and I don't care what the cause is, give me more. And when the bad thing happens, aversion arises, anger arises, despair and depression arise, which are all thwarted attachment, and the shock and the horror that bad things have happened, and how dare bad things happen. I do not deserve this. This is how we suffer on the planet, and this is because of attachment and aversion. So we live in just profound ignorance, Buddha says. So the view of karma, when we start to apply that, every millisecond a good thing happens. We should be blissful. We should be joyful. And we would never forget that this is the fruit of my past hard work. You would never forget that those veggies are the fruit of your hard work. Never for one second. You look in your bank and you see that money in there. If you really know how hard you worked, you would never take it for granted. We never take money for granted. Okay, if you're that rich, you might. You'd be arrogant. But you don't take it for granted because you know every single dollar is the fruit of your hard work. And when you know it's the fruit of your hard work, you value it and you use it wisely. That's the attitude of karma to good things happening. And then when you know that everything's impermanent and you know you've got thousands of karmic seeds in your mind, then you're not surprised when bad things happen. And then Gail's point, when you really understand the compassion wing as well, and you realize this is the fruit of your virtuous karma when good things happen, and then when the bad things happen, because you're not surprised, you don't have a panic attack, uh-oh, my negative karma's ripening now. And if you really have a good attitude, you'd be glad it's happening. Now I've just finished that karma. I gave this one little talk one time with a bunch of people, a Jew. It was a rabbi, a Catholic, a Lutheran, and a Buddhist. It sounds like a joke, doesn't it? It was a talk in Miami. And the topic was, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, the Catholic and the Lutheran gave their answers, and I didn't understand them, quite frankly. And then I gave my talk, which was about karma, and then the rabbi clapped. He said, oh, we have the same view. He was a Kabbalah rabbi. They have the view of reincarnation. And he was cracking jokes about Hitler. I mean, Jews don't crack jokes about Hitler, I tell you, but he was. And he said, we have the same view about reincarnation and karma. And he said, we have a nice saying. Every time something bad happens, you think, great, one less debt to repay. Okay, they still talk about the concept of God. But the same idea. So when you really got that view, Gail, and you recognize, because you're not sick and you're not suffering, you don't just take it for granted. You don't feel guilty. You don't feel ashamed. It's due to your virtue. You nourish it. You delight in it. And then you have compassion for others. And you see what I can do to help. That's the point. That's the way you approach. But the view of the mind and the view of karma have to go together. You can't have one without the other.
So then Pauline Whiteman's asking, how come Buddha can't fix everything for us? Is it because it's kind of rude to ask Buddha because suffering is our own responsibility?
That's like asking me this. Let's say you're, who asked it?
Pauline.
Pauline, let's say you're a musician. You've learned music. You've studied. You've played it hard. You know music. So when you play the piano, you can teach me piano, can't you? You can encourage me to play the piano. But when you play the piano, I don't get any benefit until I play the piano. You can't play the piano for me. You can't force me suddenly by your teaching me piano. You don't suddenly make me play the piano, do you? I've got to put effort into it. So in exactly the same way, you can bring a horse to water, you can't make it drink. A Buddha is not capable of changing your mind. That'd be absurd. You have to do the work. You have to do the work. So this is what helping people means. You know, you can have the knowledge of piano. You can look at people and see their potential. You can encourage them. You can love them. But in the end, they have to play the piano, baby. A Buddha is a person who gives us his own experience, who gives us the methods. He's got a powerful mind. He's clairvoyant. He can lead me in the right direction. But in the end, I've got to put my money where my mouth is. It's just so obvious.
Such a good example, because I just think of all the musical instruments I gave up playing just through laziness.
There you go, exactly.
There's quite a heartfelt one here from Deepa asking about karma. So she works at the tax office and her job is to make decisions whether people are eligible to keep their payments or not, which causes stress to a lot of people. So is she creating negative karma even though she's just doing her job?
Well, you know, what's her name again?
Deepa.
Are you there, Deepa? Where are you, Deepa? I need to talk to Deepa. Where is she?
Let me find it. Okay. Ask to unmute.
Are you there, Deepa? Talk to me.
Yes, I'm here. Yes.
Where are you? Let me see your picture.
Yes, I'm here. Are you going to see me?
I'll have to find you where you are. I can't see you. Can you see me? Come up green. Oh, now I see you, darling. Okay, good.
Yes.
So tell me more detail. What decisions you have to make?
Okay, so it's for the COVID payments, actually. So, you know, a lot of the government introduced these payments for businesses whose businesses obviously aren't working because of COVID. But there's really specific rules that businesses have to follow to get the payment. A lot of these businesses haven't been following these rules. They object to a decision. My job is to look at their circumstances, make a decision. And now we're actually ringing these people in terms of just so it's a bit more humane interaction rather than just sending them a letter.
Absolutely.
So a lot of people are very distressed. You know, we get a lot of anger. We get a lot of people crying on the phone to me.
Of course you would. But I think, okay, I mean, this is a bit like if you're a doctor and you have to tell somebody they've got cancer. How can you say you're possibly, you know, you've got the knowledge, you observe due to their, I mean, if you think of it this way, due to their past actions of smoking cigarettes, they cause themselves to get cancer. So these particular businesses, as long as you're being fair, if you're being fair and the rules are fair, then and they haven't qualified, then that's their actions, not yours. So you are a catalyst for suffering. Of course you are. You're a catalyst, but you cannot say you are a cause of their suffering. Now, from your point of view, if you are glad to tell these people they've got no money, and if you curse and swear and hate them, well, that's another discussion. You're creating negative karma by your own anger. But if you're not doing it with any intention to harm them, it's due to their actions that they don't create the cause to get the money. It's due to their past, karmically long-term, that's due to their past karma of not being generous or of stealing that they can't get the funds they need. So you're just the catalyst for it. So it's a very good opportunity for you to keep your mind very pure and be very compassionate. Then how can you possibly say you're creating negative karma? Not possible.
Right. Thank you for that.
It's up to you to be clear in your mind, though, and be very moral and very ethical and do the right thing. Don't be lazy with it. Don't be bureaucratic. Be very pure, very clear. And then accept the blame, accept the abuse, and trying to be patient and humble with it, you know.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
All right, darling.
Then Helene is asking, with her individual karma has actually been really good since COVID hit, and personally things have worked out really well, but how can she deal with all the persistent ill-contented people, the news, the everything, and this kind of expectation that everybody should be suffering? Because kind of like if we're not suffering, then it's like we're rubbing other people's noses in it.
I know. See, that's where we have to get into. Who was asking that question again? Sorry.
Helene.
Helene, so sweetheart, oh, good on you, darling. So that's where we've got to be very clear. And that's why let's say you take the view of karma, and this is the Buddhist view, when you really know that every individual person is experiencing the particular results of their own particular actions, when we really know that, then there's no space for guilt. And because in our culture, in our world, in the materialist world, we don't really have explanations of all of this. It just seems a bit like good luck and bad luck, doesn't it? Do you understand? So then we think people often, if they have money or don't get sick at other people, or even someone dies and they don't die, people have this devastating guilt. Why did I survive? Because they don't have an explanation for it. I mean, do you understand my point? It's because we don't have explanations. Now, I'm not saying Buddha's right or wrong here. That's for us to find out. But we're using here the Buddha's explanations. So when you know that well and you apply that, then you would realize it's due to your past virtue that you're not sick. But don't cross your fingers, honey. Tomorrow you're going to drop dead anyway at some point. So don't get too much caught away. So you realize it's due to your virtue, and then you have compassion. Like I said to Gail, you have compassion for others, and you read the news, but you don't have to buy into it. We have to have some kind of responsibility and accountability where we decide what we want to think. I mean, I love newspapers and magazines. I'm a real junkie, but I don't buy into people's views. I don't get angry or upset. I'm happy to read, white supremacist views just because I like to know how people think. So we've got to have, when you're firm in your own mind, what you think and what is true and what's not, you won't be influenced by others in a negative way. But if it's overwhelming you, then don't read the news. Don't do it. You've got to know where you're at, you know. Do you understand, darling?
And then, Venerable, a question from Laura. So what about if we're thinking about karma and we go, okay, so I want to have more wealth, so I'm going to practice generosity. Uh-huh. Are we kind of perverting it a little bit that way?
No, it's up to your motivation. It's this way motivation comes in. So let's look at how we create karma now. And this is a really crucial point. This is fundamental, and this gets us to the centrality of the role of the mind in everything we do. Okay, so when you create an action, let's say a good example, let's say generosity. Let's say there's a homeless person and you know about karma and you go past the homeless person. So let's just say it's going to be a plain, straightforward, virtuous action. If it's going to be a virtuous action, who asked the question again? Sorry, I forget the names.
Laura.
Laura, if it's going to be a virtuous action, Laura, this is the crucial point now. This is the distinction. There could be two people walking past that homeless person. Let's say I'm walking past a homeless person and you're walking past a homeless person. So one, if for each of us, one's going to create a negative action and one's going to create a positive action. So we're both walking past a homeless person. So in each case, for each of those actions, for it to be what they call a complete action, which is a type of action that's got four things in place, and that action will leave a seed in your mind, and that ripens as a type of rebirth. A complete action ripens as a type of rebirth. So in terms of your generosity, one, there has to be the object, a homeless person. Two, this is a crucial piece, your mind involved in the action. So there are two parts there. One is the thought, the intention. And I don't mean by good intention, meaning good intention. Intention is the very, actually the meaning of the word karma. It's mental action. The word karma means action, but the real one that does the action is the mind. So it's mental action, and that's intention. And that means volition. I will give money to that homeless person. That's bare bones thought, I will give. But what comes along with it almost immediately, and we can't tell the difference, is your motivation. So let's say a good motivation, a pure motivation, meaning virtuous, meaning you have compassion. So that is your mind involved, the intention to give based on compassion. Three, you do the action, you hand the $20. Four, the person gets the result, the $20. Speaking simply, that's a complete action. The object, the mind involved, the action, the result. Now, let's say you're a rich person and I want your money. So I'm going to be all lovey-dovey to you and all over you like a rash and you think I love you, but I don't. I just want your money. So one, object, you. Two, you can't find your wallet. So I say, oh, I'll give you $20. So I have an intention to give you $20. Motivation, complete attachment. Complete attachment to be seen as a good girl and for you to love me so you'll give me your money. My motivation stinks. There's not a fraction of virtue. Three, I give you the $20. Four, you get it. It looks like a virtuous action, but look at the difference. There's exactly the same, there's an object. Exactly the same intention, I'll give you the money. Exactly the same action, I give you the money. Exactly the same result, you get the money. The one piece that's different is the motivation. And that's the key on which everything is determined, the motivation. So if you hear in general about generosity and you know you want to have create virtue, you know the result will be you will get things. That is, you know, for next life, for example, you know you want to be reborn as a nice human being in a nice family where you don't have to work all day and be starving, so you can have enough money so you can carry on practicing your spiritual path. Honey, that's a perfect motivation for giving money. Go for it. But if you want to, even in this life, you want to be, you want to have lots of money, but you got to have the reason why you want lots of money. It was just attachment. That's not virtue. You poison the action and you'll get the opposite result. If you do it for an impure motivation, just for attachment, that is not a virtuous karma. So you won't get the result. Believe me. So it's the motivation that counts. And this is profound. We've got to really check this, you know, think of it every day. It's really important. So in the beginning stages of practice, there's no real, the very first stages of the Hinayana level, the wisdom wing level, there's no much wiggle room there. You just try to be a nice person. You try not to steal, not to kill, not to lie. You harness your energy. You control your body and speech. You be cautious. Then you get to high school, you work on your mind. You try to get rid of the delusions. Now you can go to the compassion wing and you start to be proactively good and moral and virtuous and be generous and do them and practice the bodhisattva path, which is to but have a pure motivation for what you do. So you want to get rich, honey, get as rich as you can, because then you can help so many people. That's a marvelous motivation. Don't hesitate. When you have a pure motivation, doesn't mean you have to live on you know, bread and water. You can still eat nice food, but if don't be brave. It's a bodhisattva view. Make millions of dollars. I mean, if the Dalai Lama had enough money, he could buy Tibet, for God's sake. If he had a couple of $1 trillion, the Chinese ran out of money, you could buy Tibet. So money is the most precious tool we could probably have on this planet. It's more powerful than anything. It's just the currency we use. So don't hesitate. Make bucket loads of it. But not for attachment reason. If you do, you'll get the opposite result. Motivation is everything.
So then, Venerable, how do we not second guess ourselves about our motivation? Because so many times in the, you know, the Buddhist teachings, it says adjust your motivation, and I can try and adjust my motivation. But underneath, I'm thinking, yeah, but maybe underneath, you know, my ignorance is just white-outing everything.
No, it's too nihilistic. That's nihilistic and depressing and pathetic. You've got to fake it till you make it. I mean, you're only in grade 2 music. You can't, you go, I'm really going to play the piano. And part of you say, no, I'm not really playing the piano. I'm only in grade 2. You'll never get anywhere. Give yourself a break. Of course, you're still deluded. Of course, you've got still attachment. I mean, you offer your food first before you shove it in the mouth. You offer your food. But I mean, I'm happy to offer my food, but I'm going to bloody eat it. I mean, I remember Lama Zopa on the plane one time in a very short plane journey. And, you know, he's famous for his 4-hour offerings before he eats the dinner, you know. So at one time, he was just a short plane journey. He was doing all his blessings and his offering and then visualizing all the Buddhas and offering and offering and offering and offering and offering. And they came to take the tray. And Roger said to him, Rinpoche, you want to eat your lunch? He said, oh, no, it doesn't matter. The main purpose has been achieved. Meaning, I'm more happy to offer my food. That's virtue. But I can't wait to finish the offering to put it in my mouth. That's okay. Own the fact that you still got attachment. But you put cream on the top. You put this powerful virtue on the top of it. And you're programming your mind. So be realistic where you're at. But be accepting of that, for God's sake. You can't be perfect before you're ready. What else?
There is a question from Lola about, well, then how do we purify our negative karma?
Well, this is the four R's, isn't it? The four R's. It's a really powerful psychological process. Lama Zopa says we are insane not to do it at the end of every day. So if we take the view of karma, which is that every millisecond of what you think and do and say, you're dropping seeds into your mind. If every millisecond you're dropping seeds into this garden, you at some point would start to realize, God in heaven, I better realize what kind of seeds I'm planting, because everyone will bring a fruit. Seeds bring fruits. It's their nature. So the first level of practice is don't worry about purifying it. Don't worry. You know, when you go to the doctor, the first thing she tells you is stop eating sugar. The next step is start purifying the results of the past sugar and start, you know, cleaning up your mess. But you've got to stop eating sugar first. So first we stop killing, stop stealing, stop lying, become a moral, disciplined person, harness your crazy body and speech, get some self-respect. Even that's a profound level of practice. But the next level is, how about putting atomic bombs under the trillions of seeds we must already have planted from countless past lives, not to mention this life, because there's no thought that ever goes astray. There's no action we've ever done that doesn't sow a seed. So we better start taking care of the seeds we've already planted, put atomic bombs under them to prevent them from ripening and suffering. This is what purification is. And this is already just this is just junior school practice. You control your body and speech, and then eventually you live in vows. We'll talk about that, because that's a stupendous practice as well. And then you purify. If you don't even get to high school yet, if you don't even begin to work on your mind, already you're practicing a huge, marvelous practice. You should be very content. So what is purification? Is, you know, you can do it in very formal ways with bells and all your bells and whistles and stuff. And it becomes very religious and we kind of lose track of it a bit. But for me, it's so important to do it in a very experiential way. You know, if everything we think and do and say leaves seeds in our mind, which is the law of karma, then whatever we do will bring fruits. So whatever we do that's negative will ripen as suffering, and whatever we do is positive will ripen as happiness. I mean, as Amma Yeshe says, we create negativity with our mind, so we purify it by creating positivity with our mind. You apply the antidotes. It's very powerful. It's very natural. It's psychological. Don't think of it as religion. So the four R's is a really nice way to remember it. My friend Venerable Gloria in Adelaide, I think she said that. And maybe everybody uses that. I don't know. The four R's is very practical. So the first one, and this is really important to understand, it's called regret. We have many misconceptions about this. So His Holiness, I always quote this, His Holiness one time years ago, he was asked by some fellow, what's the difference between guilt and regret? So guilt, we know about, we have it. We are past masters at guilt. And that's because of this dualistic view of punishment and reward, and especially because of our attachment to be seen as a good girl, you know? We've got that very primordially in our minds. So guilt, as His Holiness said, you look in the past and you go, I did that and I did this and I did that. And then you conclude, and I'm a bad person. This we run to automatically, and that's because of ego grasping. That's because of the delusions. We automatically, that's called blaming yourself. That's called anger. And look at what anger is. If you're mean to me, I'll say, you did this and you did that and you did this and you're a bad person. So anger is towards another person. Guilt is anger towards yourself. It's exactly the same. So, of course, we've got to look into why we over-exaggerate our badness. And this is the irony of ego is we do that. We love to hate ourselves. We love to blame ourselves. You know, I'm a bad person, we think. This is the tragedy of this misconception. So, in other words, we paint the whole of ourself with that one brush of that one action. It's just inappropriate. The key function of all delusions is that they exaggerate. You know, they exaggerate. This is a tragedy. So then His Holiness said, well, what's regret? Well, the first part is the same. You look back in the past. Well, I did do that. I did kick the dog. I did cheat on my boyfriend. I did kill that baby. I did whatever I did. You own it. And this is a difficult one because we're shouting and yelling and we don't want to own it. Because you know what? Normally we have guilt, blame, or denial. You know, that's why the lamas always say, imagine if you just eaten poison. Can you imagine how idiotic you'd be if the first response was, who put poison in my dinner? And meanwhile, you're determined to sue them like the people smoking through their throat with, and then blaming and suing Marlboro, you know? Determined. It's not, you know, because you're blaming everybody. Meanwhile, you keep eating poison. What a demented thing. The other one is, oh, I'm a bad person. I ate poison. And you just beat yourself up. It's a totally useless state of mind. There's no action there. And the third one is, you know, Rabina, there's poison in your lunch. There is not. That's called denial. We are demented. Well, this is a practical, intelligent one, recognizing that everything you think and do and say will bring results to you, knowing you don't want suffering. Then you might, oh my God, what an idiot. I can't believe I killed. I can't believe I lied. What a fool. I don't believe it. Why? Because I regret that. Why? Because I don't want suffering. It's self-respect. But we've got to cultivate it. Because often what we think regret is guilt, and we don't spell it out. Or the other one is, we think guilt is, we think regret, oh, it means I shouldn't have done it. But think of that. It's a totally useless state of mind. That's when your mother said, you shouldn't have done that. It's called anger. It's just called anger. It's meaningless. There's no benefit to, I shouldn't have done it. You did it. Now what will you do? What's the point of saying I shouldn't have done it? Where's the action there? There isn't any. But I did do it. I did eat sugar. God, what will I do about it? That's the next step. Whom can I turn to? Whom can I rely upon? I did kill, steal, lie. And then you regret. And also, and you've got to spell the words out. I regret this because I don't want suffering. You get used to the idea of karma that way. And then you can think, of course, all the things you've ever done since beginning is time. You know, if you have the view of karma nicely, anything in countless lives. Because all those seeds are in your mind waiting to ripen. You want to get out of them. You want to rid them. You don't want to put atomic bombs under them. So then you think, well, whom can I turn to? That's the next logical next step. Whom can I turn to? Whom can I, where's my doctor? Well, that's the Buddha for us. And this is the difference between the Christian view relationship with God and a Buddhist relationship with Buddha. It's completely different. So it's logical if I'm a Christian. I would regret first. That's like confessing. But the next step is I would rely upon God. And this is the point. I then would beg God to forgive me. Because forgiveness is what purifies. Not for the Buddha. He's a nice guy. He would forgive you, but it's not the issue. That for the Buddha is like going to your doctor and begging her to forgive you because you ate sugar and to please purify my cancer by her forgiveness. That's meaningless in Buddhism. It is not the point. You have to do the work. So you rely upon the doctor. You listen to her intelligent advice and you put it into practice. That's reliance. That's what refuge means, you know. So the second step, reliance, it's got two parts. First one is this one. So, you know, you'd visualize, we did that practice. You'd visualize Buddha above your head. In a particular practice, all the lamas and all the Tibetan traditions really admire. You know, in Tantra, the Vajrayana, the Bodhisattva aspect of the Buddha is not the same as the Buddha as a monk. There's another whole discussion. In the Bodhisattva aspect, looking gorgeous, is another whole thing. And they're all manifestations of the same Buddha mind, though. There's no difference. There's different sort of showing different aspects. And this particular aspect of the Buddha is related in particular to the understanding of wisdom, of emptiness. Because emptiness, when you realize emptiness, that's the real purification. That's when you cut the root. Maybe we'll discuss that before we finish. So,
Venerable, can I just jump? I'll just jump in when you're talking about regret. So, Lady Allison has just put in that given that she's had four children and killed so many lice, I think your story about the lice really resonated. Is there a recommendation how to purify so many deaths? Because she's never thought about it, and now she's actually full of regret.
That's what we're discussing now, right now. Who was it again? I forget the name.
A lady called Alison Lulam.
Okay, Alison, we're discussing it right now, so we'll go through the four steps, darling. Because if we think about it, Alison, it's a good point. We haven't thought about it. In our culture, we don't think about it. We all know we mightn't kill a human, but we don't consider, I mean, both it's the materialist view and with respect to our Christian teachings. I mean, I love my Catholic upbringing, but I was taught that God made other creatures for our benefit. They don't have souls. So that's why in our Western culture, going back to the Christian time, and then equally now the materialist view, in both cases, there's no value in other creatures, which is why we eat them for dinner. We don't think it's bad to kill them. We think it's good to kill the lice and the rats. So that's our culture. So it's very not surprising we never think about it. So the Buddhist view is really quite different. So it's quite a shock for us. So remember the bigger picture, but let me finish the four opponent powers and then we'll talk about the killing one, because this is very common for all of us, sweetheart. So, okay, the first one is you acknowledge that you did it. This is the first step. I did kill all those thousands, millions of lice. But not to mention that, you know, I mean, it's like since the beginning of this time, if you have the view of karma, this is another whole kettle of fish for us, of course. If you think you've had countless past lives, then the killing, the really best killers, this is not being horrible, is animals. We're clever at it as humans because we're technically brilliant. But animals live their lives out of this incredible suffering of ignorance, out of this incredible suffering of fear of living, like especially the wild animals or creatures. They live by being killed or killing. They eat each other or get eaten. So they live in this constant paranoia. I mean, or just casually, like look at the fish. I mean, fish live in that ocean. Every action they do is to try and hide themselves from being eaten alive by the next person. I mean, can you imagine living such a paranoid life? The nightmare, we think it's so lovely, so romantic, this wildlife. Can you imagine the nightmare? I mean, a whale, a nice, lovely whale who we think is so gorgeous, they open their mouth for one mouthful of one breakfast in their long life. 40 million little bugs, little fish go in. They're killing. It's just their life. Animals just live by killing. Not to mention the wild animals who kill out of incredible fear and rage and the tendency to kill. When you tell that mummy lion that buffalo's not happy being eaten alive for breakfast while she casually brings her babies and has hot entrails, because her mind is so programmed in past killing. So being humans, a few bit we do as humans is nothing in comparison with our countless past lives of killing, Alison. So get a perspective, you know. But indeed, it's a powerful thing to do. To regret it is incredible. So the first step is you regret. Acknowledge the fact. I did. It's amazing. I never thought of it before. Look at the lice I've killed. I mean, but forget even that, Alison. We just drive a car. I mean, some guy did some research. I remember Googling. Just on a number plate per kilometre per car, it's like trillions of bugs every day are smashed to smithereens. You know, we do it mindlessly. Even if we're vegans. You know, even if we're vegans, thinking we're so holy. Don't be ridiculous. I'm sorry. Your body is a walking zoo. Just your armpit, under your armpit's a walking zoo of living beings. And even if you're a vegan, being so holy, you know, I remember one scientist in Victoria being so annoyed about all the fundamentalist vegans and vegetarians, about how holy they are because they don't eat flesh. He said, excuse me. He talked about one wheat field where there's, you know, in the off season of no wheat, millions and millions of cute little field mice gather there. He had photos of them. They sing love songs to each other. And what do you think they do when they have to grow the wheat for the holy vegans and vegetarians? They're not going to kill those mice kindly. They slaughter them. Because we don't eat their flesh, we don't even think about it. So we can't escape the fact that just by living in this insane planet, and this is the point the Buddha's making, but just by living, we are slaughtering. So this is all we can do is be conscious of this and make his aspiration not to kill and live in a vow not to kill, which I will talk about after our break in 7 minutes. So there's different things that we can do to mitigate what we do, but it's becoming conscious of it. It's becoming conscious of it. So we do our best. So we do our best to change our mind. So the first one is we regret. We own we did do that. And you know what? I don't want that future suffering. This is compassion for yourself first, Alison. Forget the lice. Then you turn, whom can I turn to have, and you have refuge in the Buddha. You visualize Buddha above your head in this particular practice we do. Then the second part of reliance, it sounds odd here, but that's where you have compassion now for all those lice, all the creatures, all the beings you've harmed in the past, all the beings you're harming even now without thinking about it. You have such compassion. I'm going to purify for their sake. Third one is you do a practice. That's the remedy. You do a visualization and the recitation of a particular mantra. There's many remedies, many antidotes. You know, if you regret killing, you try to save lives. If you regret lying, you try to tell the truth in your daily life. But this is the most potent antidote, the most potent practice that all the lamas really praise, which is pointing out to the power of the Buddhas, which takes time for us to understand. So a visualization technique, you visualize certain things, nectar coming and visualizing, purifying, and you say a mantra. It's said to be a super potent practice, a medicine. The fourth is the resolve to not do it again. Now, this is a difficult one when it comes to killing because we just live among beings, you know, but this makes us more conscious. It makes us more conscious. And we do our best. If you meet a living being, try not to harm it. So the point about these four, this is the four steps of the four opponent powers. And we do this every day. So it's like putting atomic bombs under those tendencies and under the karmic seeds we have planted and weakens them. It's a powerful practice. And psychologically, it's very powerful. You end the day on a happy note, on a positive note, you know, because you doing the work for your benefit as well as for others. And you're making new decisions. You're digging new grooves in your mind. It's very powerful psychologically. The other thing that's very powerful about karma, this takes us time also to understand. We know, we think those lice, that they're immutable. There are lice out there and we feel it's got nothing to do with me. How dare these lice come into my house or to my body or to my dog? How come those rats are eating in my kitchen? How come those cockroaches are in my house? We feel very much that they're out there from their own side and I'm this innocent victim and they dare come invade my house. Well, no, it's not like that. It's a karmic appearance. Every sentient being we ever meet is because we met them before. And whatever they do to us is what we've done to them before. So when we own the view of karma, we realize that they're my rats. Hi, rat. They think it's their house. The cockroaches think it's their food. Why shouldn't they? It's due to karma with those cockroaches. So this is the point about the four opponent powers. Each of those steps also has a very powerful function in purifying precisely each of those four ways that karma ripens. I'm sure it's all in the course notes we gave people, Miffy. All this is in the course notes, okay? I'm quite sure. Including the purification practice. I'm sure I did it. Have a look. Everybody got the course notes, right?
We'll have a look. And if anyone hasn't got the notes, then let me know and I'll be able to get it to you.
All these teachings are in the course notes. Yeah, absolutely. So, good, Alison. So darlings, the four opponent powers. And the first one is very powerful. And this really takes time to think about. So there you are, let's say, and you've got all these cockroaches in your kitchen, right? So the first instinct we have is to get the hell out, you know, make them all go away, kill a lot, you know, get them rid of them. But the thing is, if you realize it's due to karma, then it's inexorable that you're going to come together. It's inexorable. You're going to come together. You've got the history with each other. So you can't just keep killing them because more will come. So you've got to do something about it. So regret is very fascinating. So you check it out. What's this action that I'm experiencing now? This is the third kind of karma. Experiences similar to the cause. What is it? Cockroaches are eating my food. So then clearly they're stealing your food. They've invaded your house. So think of that action. Then that's an action similar to what you must have done to them. So then you regret whatever I did to do this harm to these cockroaches. I regret having done that. And why? Guess what? I don't want this suffering, because not wanting the suffering is the reason you regret. I wish I hadn't done it. You did do it. But I regret having done that because look at this suffering. I don't want this. Well, then don't be surprised. That purifies it. That this regret purifies that result. Maybe not immediately, certainly next life. But even now, don't be surprised if you do it with great sincerity and logically. So let's say a person at work is believing that you lied. You know, it's a nightmare. You can't believe they think you lied. You know you didn't lie. That's due to your lying to them. So when you do your regret practice, it makes it much more powerful. Instead of feeling all this self-pity and outrage, you go, I must have done that action. I regret that from the depths of my heart because I do not want this suffering. Don't be surprised they start to change because the karma changes. Everything that happens out there is the fruit of our past actions. So by our changing our mind, we change the results. It's very powerful. It's very logical if you think it through. The second one, the reliance on the Buddha and on the sentient beings, this purifies environmental karma. They talk about how the very sentient beings that you harmed, the very ground that you fall down on, which harmed you, is the same ground you rely upon to stand up. So we must have harmed sentient beings in one way. The environmental result of harming sentient beings in this way is you know, the physical world harms you. So by having compassion for sentient beings and having refuge, you purify this environmental karma. The third one, doing the main practice of visualizing the mantras, that purifies the lower realms results, which of course is a bit abstract for us. And the fourth one is a no-brainer. If you vow not to kill again every day, you're digging that groove of not killing ever deeper in your mind, and you're purifying the habit to kill. So you purify all four aspects. This is what most powerful practice, most practical. And it's very empowering, and you become accountable. You realize everything is a result of your own past actions, and you could change it. It's very powerful.